No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So be part of the conversation. Call in, ask questions at 888-627-6008. We have a very special guest tonight, but before we bring him on, let me say hello to Maria. Maria, how are you?
I'm good, Michael. Thank you so much. And I'm glad to hear that you and your family are healthy and well, as are mine.
Yeah, thank God. And, you know, I just said this to Maria, and let me say this to the audience. I was tested for COVID this week, and luckily it came up negative, but five of my friends have it. For if there's anybody out there that doesn't think this is real, you need to think again. But we have tonight a very special guest with us. Luckily, he's doing well, too, I think. It's A. Scott Bolden. He really needs no introduction. You've probably regularly seen him on CNN and Fox Business and other national MSNBC, given his legal commentary. Good morning, America. He's a managing partner in Reed Smith, which is either the largest law firm in the world or one of the largest law firms in the world. He's a friend, and he's been very generous to me over the years, and I very much appreciate him being on the show tonight. Scott, welcome back to Shadow Politics.
Oh, Senator, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Let me start by asking you, because we can't have a lawyer on the show at this point in time without asking this question. Is there any other legal maneuver that you can foresee that the president could take to contest this election?
No.
Okay, well, that's pretty succinct.
I could have told you that 30 days ago, but 50 lawsuits have been dismissed. The Supreme Court has looked at the Pennsylvania case as well as the Texas case that tried to throw out something like 10 million votes and disenfranchise the voters of Michigan and Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and I think Arizona. And it's just Supreme Court has dismissed the Texas case that we're looking to disenfranchise at least 10 million people. And it's not just embarrassing. It's real damage to our democracy, our Constitution, and what differentiates America from other countries. And we are that shining country on the hill, as I say, is that the peaceful transfer of power, which distinguishes us, has not been so peaceful. And much like ignoring science and accepting fiction, Trump supporters who may not be true members of the GOP party, although several signed on to that Supreme Court nonsense brief, you know, they need to look at the facts, stop listening to fiction, and move forward together, whether we can agree or disagree. We all want what's best for this country, and there's got to be a way we can move forward together, not only support this president, but support this country and get it back to moving forward versus what we've seen over the last 4 years. So those are my best thoughts. May not be legal, but there's no maneuver left. There may be some maneuvering next week when the electors meet and send their elector votes to Congress. It would be dumb because the GOP doesn't have the power or authority in the House or Senate to upset those election numbers, as you know. And so while there may be some maneuvering, it's just further embarrassment. And, you know, the last 4 years of Trump, we knew what we were getting with Trump. Nothing Donald Trump has done has surprised me. What has surprised me is the enablers, those who stood silent, those who actively supported him, because his power comes from their fear and their support of what they would not support with anyone else because of self-preservation. And few, if any, have put their country ahead of party. And even those who have criticized the president still vote with him 95% of the time. These are facts and issues we cannot ignore over the next 4 years. They've got to be held accountable before we can move this country forward. So a lot to think about and a lot of work to do with those who don't side with us as Democrats.
Well, one more legal question for you, Scott. I mean, that's very well said. Isn't there something the court can do? I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know. But isn't there something the court can do to a lawyer if he brings too many frivolous lawsuits? Isn't there action? Are any of these part of, you know, Trump's legal team? Are they culpable for the fact that they're bringing all these lawsuits?
Yeah, and well, they can be certainly sanctioned by the court. That costs them money. They can be referred to the Bar Association. A number of them have been referred to the Bar Association. Anybody can file a bar complaint. I know that at least one elected official in Congress has filed, or series of a number of them have filed complaints against various bar associations in these jurisdictions for Rudy Giuliani and some of the other lawyers. I'd be remiss if I didn't note that several of the big firms that were involved early on over the years, they walked away. They're just arguments they're not prepared to make, basically. And so I commend my colleagues in big law who not only have a reputation, but excellence as a standard by being at a big law firm with a lot of resources. And several of them refused to be a part of those 50 lawsuits. I mean, you got to stand in court in the well of the courtroom and make an argument. And if your argument doesn't match what you say on paper or match what the political rhetoric is and what you want, and you don't have verifiable, credible evidence or fact, I don't care about affidavits. Many of the affidavits after interviewing or putting on testimony from these alleged credible witnesses by the GOP lawyers and by Trump lawyers and the RNC lawyers, they've been found to be non-credible or not credible. That's a hell of a thing. When you're in court, in federal court and state court, that's something that hardly ever happens, and no lawyer wants to be in that position. And in several of these lawsuits, that's been the case. Two or three scathing written opinions by GOP appointed lawyers GOP appointed judges or Trump appointed judges, right? Three of them on the Supreme Court. At least one or two in the Pennsylvania case who rejected this nonsense, who refused to say I'm not going to be part of disenfranchising American voters in this election. I don't care who appointed me, if you will, and that's real courage. I think the lesson from historians for the Trump's 4 years will not only remember his abject failures as a president, but they will remember the judiciary, because the judiciary has been the one line of defense to normalcy and human decency. If you look at all the lawsuits that have been filed, not just for this election, but over the last 4 years in regard to the DACA kids, in regard to the wall, in regard to anti-immigration, the majority of these courts have been the last line of defense and have defended the Constitution and turned back several initiatives by Trump, or accepted a watered-down version that met the constitutional tests that are always hard to meet. And so the judiciary will be the the real heroes of these last 4 years, if you ask me. Not all of them, not every decision, but the majority of the decisions we've seen have kept us in lockstep with American democracy, and that's important.
Well, yeah, I would imagine that you would be proud, and I am proud, of the court system and how they've handled this, that they haven't listened to any of this nonsense, and also some of the Republicans, some of the, you know, the Secretary of State of Georgia, mm-hmm. even though 19 other Republican Secretaries of State signed on to this frivolous nonsense, you've got to give it to him and the governor and other Republicans. I'm monopolizing Scott's time, Maria. Do you have a question?
I do. First of all, Scott, it's a pleasure to be introduced to you, albeit through technology, and I am in awe of your career and the amazing things that you've done and accomplished.
Oh, thank you.
And continue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're a true inspiration, and I mean, you walk the walk with everything that you do. And I'm curious, I want to call back what you said about, so I've been a registered Republican my whole life. I voted for President-elect Biden this time because of my disgust and abhorrence with what Trump has done during his time in office. So I've realized now I'm voting for the person, not the party. But what I don't understand about the Republican Party leaders, as you mentioned, is why hasn't somebody stepped forward and said, like a Mitt Romney, who has, you know, said a few things, but this is wrong, and we need to make better, and we need to stop this, and this is embarrassing, and all the things that you just mentioned that the Republicans aren't doing. We're without a leader, the Republican Party, in my estimation. Mm-hmm. Why isn't somebody stepping up and acting presidential and taking care of us until President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in?
Well, it's about self-preservation, political self-preservation. Trump has not only taken over the party, but Trump supporters who may or may not be supportive of the GOP make up a lot of these jurisdictions, a lot of these districts, and people in the Senate and people in the House who are members of the GOP and have been elected, many of them Tea Party members, have become beholden to Donald Trump in exchange for their self-political preservation so that they can get reelected. He may be the titular head of the party, but the Trump supporters have not only invaded the RNC and the GOP, right, but they make up a large portion of voters in the districts of the House of Representatives who are elected, who had GOP representatives, and the same in the red states in the Senate. That's undeniable. Remember, the critical thing not to miss about this presidential election, and thank you for voting for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and I hope to work with you, and I hope you work with others on the Democratic and Republican side to make this country better. Let's not forget, close to one out of every two votes that were cast for Biden or Trump were for Trump, right?
Mm-hmm.
Close to one out of two. And that says a lot about this country. You know, my mother used to say, you know, stay close to your political, or better yet, stay close to your enemies, right? Pay attention mm-hmm. to them. You can learn a lot about yourself from your critics. Now, what we got to do, we can't ignore the Trump voters and supporters, whether they're violent or nonviolent, whether they're business leaders, or whether they're racist, whether they're just frustrated with the country. Because let's remember, a lot of those voters, most of them voted for Barack Obama several years ago out of sheer frustration and wanting change, right? They didn't, in their view, didn't get it from Barack Obama. They certainly haven't gotten it from Trump, but they've been so brainwashed to think that they have, they'll do anything, including commit violence. But we have to figure out a way to listen and extrapolate from what they're saying, right? I'm not talking about supporting them and condoning their bad conduct or them being humanly indecent in regard to the American democracy. What I'm saying is something's wrong in this country when the second most highest vote getter or the second highest vote getter in the history of presidential elections is Donald Trump with 74 million, and the top vote getter in the history of presidential elections is Joe Biden. Something's fundamentally wrong. We're more than divided, right? There's a part of our segment of society that just is living in an alternative reality. And we've got to figure out how to bring them back into the fold and figure out what's bugging them so we can address what's bugging America. It's the only way to do it. It can't be we won, they lost, go to hell. It can't be that because this happened twice now. He just lost the second time. So something's going on in America, and we got to figure out what that is with that voting population who support Donald Trump.
Well, let me ask you about the election. You know, I've been in politics for 40 years, and I used to be Reverend Jesse Jackson. I was his direct mail consultant for his presidential campaign. The Democrats have, for 40 years, you know, I have to be honest about it, we've taken black people for granted. We assume that they're going to vote Democratic. It's become even more obvious to me as I represent the District of Columbia, because they feel the same way about the District of Columbia. Our seats at the convention are always at the top of the convention hall because the Democratic Party in Washington, D.C. has never voted. We've never voted for a Republican for president. So they take it for granted. So what does the Biden, you think the Biden administration is going to represent African-Americans in the way that they deserve? I mean, if it hadn't been for Clyburn, just to begin with, Joe Biden probably wouldn't have gotten the nomination. So do you think he will live up to his, pledge to address systemic racism?
Well, he better. I thought your question was going to be, was he going to make the necessary appointments of African Americans? Was he going to support an urban agenda? And was he going to be a fierce defender or advocate for racial equity? I think he's going to be all of those things, right?
Good.
But here's the rub, okay? We have to make him do it. He can agree with us conceptually, but Joe Biden and Kamala Harris owe a lot of different groups a lot of different things, at least in their view of the world, vis-a-vis coming out to vote and beating Donald Trump. Now, having said that, one thing we got to do is after inauguration, we as Democrats and we as African Americans have got to leave the inauguration and go to work. We've got to make Biden and Harris do what we want them to do, because they're not going to do it because they simply agree with it and it's on their agenda. It's the history of presidential politics, something we did not do with Barack Obama. And that's why you see several of the Congressional Black Caucus members and other black political and business leaders affirming and trusting but verifying ahead of these appointments, not after the appointments, that Biden is making to keep him accountable. They've learned something from how they dealt with Barack Obama as the first black president of the United States. And that's a good thing, because every other group who wants something out of any administration makes them do it, whether it's raising money, whether it's building coalitions. We got work to do, right? And so until we do that, right, this is the beginning. You know, if you wait till after the appointment, that's a complaint. If you step forward to Biden and say, I'm going to remind you of who brought you to the dance, that's accountability. That's affirmance, if you will, or affirmation beforehand, just to keep you honest. And we got to do that. And by the way, Biden and Harris expect that, and they should not reject that, right? This is all about accountability, because I tell you, without South Carolina and John Clyburn, I got to tell you, we may have a different nominee and we may have a different result. And getting Donald Trump out and getting back to human decency was never more important in the history of this experiment called the United States of America.
Well, you know, I've got to just add to what you just said that one of the great things that I've gotten to do, one of the great honors that I've had, is I got to meet and talk to Darcy Hight. And unfortunately, at her memorial service, I went to her memorial service as well. And that's what President Obama said. President Obama said Darcy Hight was in his office every week She was there to remind right. him. You know, mm-hmm. he said she never let me off the hook. She was in there. Mm-hmm. She was in there with her big floppy purple hat every week, reminding me of what I needed to do. So we really yes, need sir. To do that. Yeah,
yes, one of my greatest.
Like Maria said, it's called walking the walk.
Right.
Right.
Hey,
right.
Scott, may one I ask greatest, you?
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, please.
I was going to say real quick, one of my greatest honors as a lawyer over 35 years was arguing a case in D.C. Federal court in front of Dr. Height. And I looked behind me, and she was in the audience just nodding her head and stuff. And it was just really a real honor and privilege for her to listen to my argument on behalf of the Recreation Wishlist Committee several years ago. And she was just a great lady. So I just wanted to share that with your audience, you all in that audience, your audience. Go right ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And you know, wait, Maria, before you say that, now you've got me started, Scott. I also, the first time I met her and got to talk to her at a hearing in front of a House committee, she took my hand and said, thank you for all you do. And mm-hmm. I went to my wife and I said, I can't believe that Dorothy Height is thanking me. She was she was also just so gracious and such a leader.
Yes, she was, very much so.
Go ahead, Maria.
I wanted to ask Scott, so you did your undergraduate at Morehouse and your law degree from Howard University. And mm-hmm. in my research, it suggests that you had a fair amount of mentors along the way. And I'd like to ask you, how important was that, do you think, for you and your success academically and professionally?
Well, my greatest mentor was my father. I'm a second-generation lawyer. He was a criminal defense lawyer and civil rights lawyer in the state of Illinois for 30-plus years and then went to the bench. And, you know, he was my hero growing up from the moment I stood in the – he stood in the well of a courtroom in southern Illinois, and he and I were the only black folks in the courtroom. And I never will forget, at 8 years old, he made me sit right behind him in the audience. He asked that I sit at the table, but they denied him that in Collinsville, Illinois, I think the city was. And so, you know, when you grow up in a home with a lawyer and then later a judge, the concepts and precepts of justice and equality and fairness and doing the right thing and giving back to the community are right up front. I mean, at 2 or 3 years old, I was on the picket line with my parents desegregating public schools in Will County and Cook County and hospitals and fighting for voters' rights. I'm sorry, fighting for worker rights. And so it was just an incredible experience. And I was painfully aware of the racial dichotomy in this country, even growing up in Joliet, Illinois, and it made me very comfortable with the discussion on race. I never had a problem with that racial difference. I always had a problem with why so many others have issues with race or having a dialogue on race, good, bad, or ugly. That's the one thing that's missing. We've never had that national dialogue or race reconciliation dialogue or commission to address the wrongs committed against African Americans during slavery and segregation and Jim Crow. But he influenced me to the point this way. I've been a partner at a big law firm that is a majority law firm, but I've never lost my compass in regard to supporting communities of color, fighting for communities of color, whether it was through my legal work, community work, or political work. And I've been unafraid of fighting and defending black folks, whether it's in the firm or in the community or in the country at large. And I've been able to do that while generating millions of dollars in fees for one of the largest law firms in the world. And I'm super proud of that because Reed Smith has given me the opportunity to do more than practice law, but to be a community leader, a business leader, a civil rights leader of sorts, and a political leader. And there are very few firms out there, I think, would have given me that leeway because their culture is built upon what I value and what my dad valued. So I start with my father, always. He's 87. He's still with us, and he's in 50-50 health, as I say. Whether he's with me in person or in spirit, he's always my guide, my moral guide, my human decency guide. Super important, super, super important. Of course, there were other mentors along the way, in college as well as law school, and too many to name, if you will, but I stand on their excellence. And when I go to court or when I'm in some leadership role, I'm always painfully aware that I owe them a debt of excellence, right? To achieve and to be excellent every day, to strive for excellence every day. And I may fail, right? But every morning I get up and I go into that fight thinking about those who came before me, thinking about my dad, Martin Luther King Jr., Thurgood Marshall, you name it. These were legends, legendary leaders, and I am an extension of them. So you got to think like you're an extension of this greatness to be great. I think you do, because if you don't, then you could be in a lot of different places, take a lot of different positions, but you need a moral compass, and those leaders gave us that. And that's what I try to emulate, and I stand on their shoulders every day. And everybody else ought to have someone in history whose shoulders they stand on, because you can get lost out here without that guidance.
And so, your mom was an activist too, right? And then later got an education later in life, which I just started my master's in 2015 and got another one in 2019 and getting my PhD, and I'm thinking she did it before me, which is an inspiration to me.
right. You know, my mom married my father at 19. He was 21, and they were married for 40 plus years before she passed away. I tell folks all the time that I learned how to be a man from my father, but my mother narrated that journey to manhood, and she did. She was such a faithful civil rights partner with my dad, and so definitive in her views. She was a fierce freedom fighter, more so than my father. You know, my father was a lawyer. You know, he'd look at both sides and stuff. But my mother, she was relentless when she got an issue. You'd love my mother, because my mother was uncompromising unless she had to at the end.
Well, that's mothers too, isn't it? You know, they always see the best in their children, and they always push for them. But let me ask you something, Scott. It's interesting what you just said about how you always had your moral compass, but you've made a lot of money for your law firm. How can we convince people that racial justice doesn't cost us money? Because I think that's what a lot of people on the other side feel. You know, Marie and I had people on our show earlier last year that talked about reparations. Mm-hmm. One of them, I can't remember his name, but he's an expert on the subject from Duke University. And, you know, how do we convince them that racial justice isn't just something that's appropriate because it's just, but also it forms a better, you know, we make a more perfect union when we do that. And you can, and there, you know, I made a good living in politics as a consultant, and I always worked for public interest groups and downtrodden groups. And you know, it doesn't cost us money. It actually makes us money in the long run. What do you think we can do to convince people of that?
Well, I go back to my mother, who used to say to me all the time before the good Lord took her, that if all you're doing is working and making money and not giving back to the community and doing the right thing, then you're only living 50% of the good life the Lord gave you. And, you know, she was absolutely right. And so I think you got to chart your own course. I think you got to remain committed to making communities of color better. And that doesn't mean you give up providing for your family. You can do both. You just got to commit to doing that. That means, you know, my father says, you got to be a capitalist before you can be a socialist. So you're always going, the movement's always going to need money.
Right.
That's you're always going to need money. There's nothing wrong with that. But he would say, and so many other black leaders say, I don't mind you making money. Just don't take away from your community as you make that money, and you've got to give back to the community and to the cause. And so the other thing that's really important, because the movement, the civil rights movement and the racial justice movement isn't just with black people and brown people, but with people that don't look like me, right? And one of the things, anytime we've had real change in racial justice over 400 years, it has included people who, whether they were the abolitionists or other ones, that don't look like me, that are white Americans. And so, you know, one of the biggest challenges I have with my colleagues, or not necessarily my colleagues, but with folks that don't look like me, is that I find that they fear giving up their white privilege, whether or that they benefit from it, or whether they take advantage of it, that somehow giving up their white privilege is some way going to cost them. Is racial justice going to cost them their white privilege? And we got to be real careful of that, because if you were born into white privilege and you didn't earn it, then you can't lose it. But the racial justice movement isn't about anyone losing anything. It's about making the playground fair, if you will, giving everyone equal opportunity. That doesn't mean it takes from you. It means it empowers you, and it empowers others that don't, that are black, white, yellow, and brown. And we got to embrace that, because America, in regard to freedom, justice, and equality, can never meet its own standard, right? In this experiment of ours called American democracy, it can never meet that standard and those goals and objectives until everyone has an equal opportunity to do so. And, you know, it's so hard, because we're all about self-preservation, but there are those of us who are born in the poverty and born in the circumstances, and then there are others that are born in the white privilege. And we got to create that opportunity for everyone. And so we shouldn't fear, none of us should fear racial equality. You know, in 2045, according to Pew Trust, this is going to be a country of color, right? And I think some of the issues that Trump voters have, and the Proud Boys and the Nazi Party and the White Supremacist Party, is that somehow that us turning to becoming a country of color is going to somehow be to their demise. Well, you know, if you're a white supremacist group, you need to have some demise. That's the first thing.
Right.
But even average white Americans don't need to be concerned about that, because I think black people are not, they want their fair share. They're not looking for retribution or payback. Sure, they'd like reparations for slavery. And I agree, that's the right thing to do, if you could ever get the right definition going on what those reparations look like.
Right.
But 2045 is coming, and there are a lot of people who fear that. And, you know, I'm often telling my white colleagues in media and political organizations, there's no basis for that fear, if you will. Okay? All African Americans want is their fair share and a fair shot at the American dream. And if we can all get that, then you don't have to give up anything. It doesn't matter, you know? So those are my thoughts on that subject.
And, well, and I just got to add to that, that I was, I grew up, I was never poor, but I was always broke. And I was orphaned. I was orphaned as a teenager, but I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, and moved just before both my parents died to Montgomery County. And I used to go back to Newark, because my grandmother lived there, and I, you know, while there was a hall monitor at my high school in Newark, at the high school I would have gone to, there were National Guardsmen armed walking through the halls because of all the and I always said to myself, I'm only alive because my parents moved me to Montgomery County, to a nice white suburban. So even those of us that you know didn't have, you know, a swimming pool in the backyard, a big car in the driveway, we all benefited from white privilege, and we've got to mm-hmm. we've got to realize that. And I think another thing is we're all self-made people in America. It's amazing to me. I know people. I've met people that have inherited millions of dollars. That'll tell you, like Donald Trump, that he mm-hmm. made. You know that he's a self-made man, and especially as a politician. My wife always tells the kids, "Your dad's in politics. He walked barefoot 10 miles to school every day, uphill in both
ways.
You know, yes. both ways, right? So, you know, there's that thing we have as Americans, too, where we think we're all self-made. Let me ask you about Georgia. What do you mm-hmm. think about Georgia? Do you think, first, I want to give you my dream, and you tell me if you think that we can make this a reality. If we win okay. both Senate, if we win both Senate seats in Georgia, we would have a tie in the Senate, and we've already passed the statehood bill in the House, which we assume will pass again when it's reintroduced. And if we can suspend the rules in the Senate, which we call the nuclear option, we can get rid of the filibuster temporarily. We could pass it in the Senate as well. And wouldn't it be wonderfully ironic if Kamala Harris, a Howard University graduate, was the person that cast the deciding vote to make the District of Columbia state? You think we got any chance of that pipe dream coming true?
Well, certainly winning the two Senate seats is plausible. We got to work real hard to get that done in Georgia. It won't be easy. You can see where some of the counties have closed off early voting outlets and moved machines or ballot mail-in, ballot drop boxes, and what have you. So we got a lot of work to do, and it's not money. There's a ton of money going into Georgia right now. It's a ground game, and whoever does the ground game better in that purple state, because despite winning the state by 12,000 votes, that doesn't make it purple. You got to do it a couple times, or that doesn't make it blue, rather. That's the first thing. The second thing is this, okay? Senator, know your history. The last time the Dems controlled all three houses, the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, was during a period of time when Bill Clinton was president. And while there was certainly talk statehood and a vote for Eleanor in the House, it never happened, right?
Yeah.
See,
right.
My view on statehood is that the Republicans tell you straight up they're not for it because it would add two Democratic Senate seats and House of Representatives seat or seats, right? But the Democrats will pay you lip service to it. It's in their platform. It's in their Democratic plank, but are they prepared to act on it? Maryland and Virginia historically have blocked it because 65% of everyone working in the District of Columbia on any given day of the week is from Maryland and Virginia, and they're not taxed at the source of their income. They're only solely taxed in Maryland and Virginia because we're not a state. D.C. is not a state. Now, that being said, it's encouraging if the Dems can control all three houses, but it's not guaranteed that statehood or self-determination is going to be in order. We've got to make them do it. During Clinton's 8 years, we were unable to make them do it. And we got to figure out who our friends are and who our enemies are, because even our friends could be our enemies, right? I'm not close enough to know what the Maryland senators and the Virginia senators, what their view of the world is, but their constituencies don't want it because that means they're going to be taxed, even if they get these Democratic seats. And so as a former state party chair for the D.C. Democratic Party, my 2 or 3 years as chair and being on the inside looking out, I was quite disillusioned with not the Republicans, because I knew where they stood. I was quite disillusioned with the Democrats at the House level and the Senate level, primarily the Senate level, because making that dream of statehood a reality was within the reach, and it just never materialized for whatever reason. I'm no expert on it, but I know it didn't happen. And so we got to be careful when we talk about the Dems controlling all three houses and statehood, because until we make them do it or they do it, you know, then it's still just a dream and a hope. We're in no better position in controlling those houses, at least based on history. And so I was going to ask you that question. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think that, first of all, now there have been some changes. We have all four senators from Maryland and Virginia on the bill, on our statehood bill. So they've changed a little bit. But I think we have to embrace this idea of getting two more Democrats. You know, we've talked traditionally about how people should do this because it's the right thing to do. And I think of legislation like the Equal Rights Amendment, where women have done the same thing, and that still hasn't passed after 30 years. So I think we need to put something in it for America, because right now it only affects us. But I think if we stand up there and say, hell yes, there's going to be two more Democrats, and that's going to help every Democrat. That's going to help Democrats in California, Michigan, and Ohio, and Illinois, and they need to get behind us, because 126 members of Congress stood behind these frivolous lawsuits. The President of the United States nominated and confirmed Amy Coney Barrett, the Senate confirmed her, to put her in the Supreme Court at the last minute. And they're packing the court. Let's us pack the Senate. Let's get two more. Because you're going to elect two liberal, probably progressive, senators from Washington, D.C. And, you know, and if you want, if you progressives want more senators, D.C.'s the place. And in the end, you're doing the right thing anyway. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like, you know, it's not just us pressing our advantage, but I think we got to put something in it for America, because right now America doesn't support us. You know, they do half of America doesn't support us.
Yeah, I agree with you. And however we get to the promised land, we need to figure out how to get to the promised land.
That's right.
If that means giving something to America and making it make sense to them, then so be it. And we, you know, we got to tap our GOP friends. We can't forget about the other side. There's got to be some accountability, no doubt about it. But you know, the Republicans, the majority of them aren't for it, and some moderate or even left leaning GOP members could be our friends on it. But we have to make them do it. Right? America doesn't understand, in the hinterlands, as my father would say. They don't understand Washington, D.C. and what our political status is. They believe that we pay taxes, we fight wars, and that we vote for the president. So therefore, we are something. We're a federal enclave or we're a state. But, you know, when I talked to my dad about taxation without representation, he kind of says, what do you mean? You've got a congresswoman in Congress. Well, yeah, but she doesn't have a vote. And the feds, and then they say the feds take care of a lot of our sources, not our resources. They give us a lot of resources to operate. Well, that was negotiated because we had no choice. We were going broke, if you will. And so there's a lot of misunderstanding about the intricacies of D.C. not being a state and being a district, if you will. And they understand Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands better than they understand D.C.
Yeah, it's crazy. And, you know, one of my great influences, everything I learned from of importance in politics, I learned from a Broadway musical. And, you know, I think of Porgy and Bess, God Bless a Child That's Got His Own. We can't, because those congressmen do not take care of us. If anything, they work against us. Maria,
absolutely.
I'm sorry, I'm monopolizing Scott's time. Go ahead.
So, Scott, this is kind of a national question to you about the strides that we've been trying to make in our country including diversity, equity, and inclusion conversations, mm-hmm. including there's something that they've just started called 110. It's 1 million careers for Black Americans in 10 mm-hmm. years, and they've got about 35 corporations signed up for it. And then mm-hmm. we have the book that Ibram X. Kendi wrote, How to Be an Anti-Racist. Mm-hmm. What are mm-hmm. your thoughts mm-hmm. about those conversations that we're starting to have that I don't think that we used to have? Do you think that that's helping make progress, or is it lip service?
I think it's huge, first of all, to even be having these courageous conversations and this racial reckoning, racial awakening, racial awareness in all over America, majority companies and law firms and accounting firms. But the rub in all of this is going to be action, right? Mm-hmm. And until we take affirmative steps, right, to have courageous conversations about race in this country, to be fearless about it, and I'm talking about Black folks and white folks, be fearless about it, because and these conversations have to be rooted in tolerance and respect and accountability, even forgiveness, if you will. You know, I tell my colleagues all the time, I don't want you to be anti-racist. I want you to be anti-racism. Every one of us, Black or white, has a story of racism in this country. We've observed it or been subject to it and what have you, right? I want all of us to take those experiences and share it, because that's the only way we're going to have an honest dialogue about all of that's wrong with the race question and be fearless about it. Secondly, Reed Smith, my law firm, we're having those courageous conversations internally, and it's just been enlightening, if you will. Whether you observed racism, whether you participated in some a racist act, or you interrupted some racist act. When I say I want you to be anti-racism, every day I want my colleagues, Black or white, to do something to oppose racism, right? To not ignore it, to not walk away from it, to not have people around you who say racist things, right? I want you to do something about it. And until we get everyone doing something about it, not tolerating it, right? Not using words that are hurtful in this common dialogue, standing up to it. You know, none of us were born with a gene called racism. Mm-hmm. We've been taught racism, environmentally or even in our homes, right? And so now, if you saw the protests over George Floyd worldwide, the most incredible thing and the most powerful thing I thought was that these weren't just Black and brown folks out there protesting. These were white folks protesting. And mm-hmm. they were protesting because they saw this injustice and they said, this is not my America. I don't want this to be my America. And so they just stand up. And there were young people and even older folks who were saying, enough is enough, right? Police reform. Whether you believe in defunding the police or not, but they wanted police reform. They wanted justice. They want to be part of an America that recognizes everyone for their value and their worth, whether they're Black or white. And so it's a huge first step. Now, we got to take advantage of it, right? We got to act. We got to move on it. We got to eradicate this cancer of racism from our public life and private lives, right? And so it's up to those companies and up to each of us to determine whether it's going to be lip service or an affirmation, right? Mm-hmm. I'm betting that it's an affirmation of change, because this is a seminal moment. If we don't make this a seminal moment, we're going to miss that moment, and things may get better, but they may not, right? And with 2045 coming, there are a lot of people that don't look like me that fear this being a country of immigrants. We are a country of immigrants, but of brown immigrants and a country of color. And we've got to address that. We've got to make people understand and appreciate what true equality means. And I think we've made a great first step to it, right? But there are a lot more steps. It didn't happen overnight that we got here, because it's remained unresolved, right? Now we just got to eliminate it. And we cannot eliminate it without locking arms with our Black, brown, and white brothers and sisters and moving forward in this country. If we don't lock arms, if we're not on the same page, if we don't move forward together, biracially, triracially, then we're not going to get to the end zone on this. And it takes a lot of hard work. It's not going to be easy. There's going to be a lot of hurt feelings, if you will. But we got to get there, not just for America, but to save ourselves. To save ourselves. And that's what's at stake. That's what's at stake.
And what's interesting about that, what I've found, the more diverse the environments that I've been in, the more that we have thrived as an organization or as a community or as, the bottom line. And I sit on the board of trustees for the university that I'm getting my PhD in, and we have gay and trans and Native American and Black and lesbian and Jewish and Hispanic and disabled and senior citizens and PhDs and attorneys. And we're having these conversations all year, especially since George Floyd. And I'm thinking, I've never been in a more diverse group of people in my life, and yet it's still urgent for us. And we're making our charters to make sure that we have the lens of diversity and inclusion and equity and all of that, and again, anti-racism and et cetera. And I think that it's going to be, we're going to thrive even more, let alone, I don't know why people are challenged by it. To me, it's like, it's the best thing ever.
Well, God bless them. God bless them.
You know, I've got to add, too, when it comes to George Floyd, that whole experience, I think of this African-American doctor that I heard on a show one time say that he hated his mentor because he was at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, one of the top medical schools in the country. He was ready to go into suburban Philadelphia and make a good living for himself. And this guy sent him to an emergency room in Harlem where he had spent 30 years of his career. And he said before he knew that that place was there, he was okay without, you know, without paying attention to things like that. But once he saw
it. Because he didn't have to.
Didn't have to. And once he saw it, he couldn't turn his back on it. And I think that was a lot of the whole thing with George Floyd. We watched this man be murdered on TV. Right. I mean, he was murdered right before our eyes.
Right.
By this guy that could have given a damn one way or the other. And I think, you know, it's easy for us to ignore it when we don't see it. But when we see it, it's hard for us to turn our backs on it. And I hope you're right, Scott. And I hope you're right, Maria. I hope that we've taken a giant step forward and we keep going. But we've run out of time with you, Scott Bolden. I don't know how this happened. We've got a thousand more questions.
Because of my verbosity. I tend to talk long in my answers, so forgive me.
No, fabulous.
I just want to make this offer to you right now. I'm going to volunteer to be your campaign manager. I don't know why you're not. You ran for city council. I don't know why you're not running again. But, you know, I work for free. So next time you want to run for something, all you got to do is call me up, and I'm happy to be your campaign manager.
Well, you got a deal, but I just can't afford it now. You know, I went back to the law firm, and then the twins got older and had to go to college, and the rest is history. I got a granddaughter in college now, so it's an affordability issue.
No, I know. I have three children. The third one graduates from college next week, and I'm like, praise Jesus, we got all three of them through.
Well, Mo Vella said that to us just last month that he was working with then Vice President Biden. He said, I finally had to leave because I couldn't afford to keep working in the White House.
I mean, the mission is great, but, you know, colleges and universities are not inexpensive. But, it is what it is. Plus, I'll be honest with you, I really like being on the outside of politics and advising, counseling, fundraising and what have you. I never liked the scrutiny that came along with campaigning or being a public figure or an elected official. I never was comfortable with it because there were no rules. In court, you know, in the law, there are rules and you say, hey, you violated this rule or you didn't. In politics, there are no rules to violate. I mean, they just run roughshod, if you will, a lot of times and stuff. So I'm comfortable being on the outside looking in.
Okay. Well, when I run for shadow president,
you got it. You got it.
Thank you so much, Scott. Every week we leave you with a song, America. This one goes out to Scott. I don't know if you're a Nina Simone fan, but this is Nina Simone with I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. Thank you, Scott. We wish you the happiest holidays with your lovely family and your collegiate grandchild. And we hope to talk to you in the new year.
Absolutely. You all both be safe and thank
continued
you both very
success.
Much. Have a great holiday. Yeah.
And thanks. To you. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Goodbye.
Okay, Maria, you're on.
We always want to thank our listeners for making us a priority and also to pay our respects to Charlie Parker, who passed away from COVID complications.
Yeah, what a sweet man he was, right?
Yeah, he was. Terrible.
Yeah.
Give the people their right to vote.